Welcome to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast with Julian Castelli. Each week, we talk with senior tech leaders to explore stories and insights about the challenges involved with growing technology companies. We hope that these stories can help you become a better leader and help you navigate your own growth journey.
Hello. Today, we are going to talk with Eric Morgan, a multiple-time CEO who has led several SaaS and technology companies through very exciting journeys of growth and multiple exits. And I'm looking forward to learning from his experience. Please welcome Eric Morgan. Hey,
Hello,
Eric.
Hello, Julian. Hi, how are you? Good to see you.
Likewise, good to see you as well. I'm excited to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, Eric, you've done a lot of great things. You've been a business leader for your entire career and have had great impact. Today, we want to talk about your Workfront journey. Tell us a little bit about Workfront. What does the company do?
Sure. Yeah. Workfront is a company based here in Utah. I would say the best way to describe it is a collaborative work management, SaaS-based cloud work management product. The company helps our clients to manage projects and really work across a whole wide spectrum of things, not just sort of traditional project management. But at the end of the day, the simplest way to kind of think about it is it's a product that is a cloud-based collaborative project and work management solution. And that's really, you know, as I arrived with the company in 2011, that's really what we were focused on and doing.
Okay, so you come in at 2011. How large is the company at that point? How many employees? What's your revenue level?
So we're probably right around just over $20 million in revenue. And again, it was a SaaS business. So it was essentially an ARR business. And I'm going to say at the time, it's been a little while, I'm going to say we had probably a couple hundred employees.
Okay. And you were there in 2011. And then when you left, what was that, 2016?
Yeah, in 2016.
And how large were you at that point?
The company was right around $100 million. And in terms of employees, I'm going to say we were probably in the 600 plus range at that point.
Wow. So a 5X increase in revenue, 3 or 4X increase in employees in just 5 years. Sounds like you knocked it out of the park.
Well, yeah, it was a lot in between those 5 years, but yeah.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about for sure. I just want to benchmark it, but I think that's why I'm so excited about having you on. You've got to have some great stories to have that kind of achievement. So your project management software, who are your customers? Who are you selling to?
At the time, it was really a wide range of customers. We went from some very large Fortune 500 type clients, a handful of those, to some very small business clients. So we're sort of at the time, and this is one of the things we're talk about, we're sort of all over the map, frankly, in terms of who we were going after. And that was one of the areas I had to dig into to really understand how that was going to be sustainable.
And what brought you to the company? What was the story of you joining, and what was your mandate when you joined?
Yeah, so I had left. I was running a company previously. We sold it, and I was in the market, got the call. And the board was looking to bring somebody in. The founder had done a great job of building up the company to that level, really established product market fit, and had a lot of really good things going. But the concern was just really scaling the business. They knew the founder himself, as well as the investors, knew there was a lot more upside opportunity with this product, and wanted to see the growth, accelerate. They hadn't really made a major investment in a senior leadership team. They were just starting to do it at the time. And they realized they needed somebody to come in who'd sort of been there and done that. And that's when I got the call.
Perfect. Who was the private equity firm?
At the time, it was a company called OpenView, which many of your listeners may know. A very good early stage company of VC that does a lot of content publishing and is really a leader in SaaS.
I like their material.
And the product-led growth is one of the areas they've really been focusing on. The other one was a Greenspring, which is maybe a little lesser known. They're out of Baltimore. And ultimately, I brought in additional investors. A lead investor who came into our growth round over that time was JMI.
Okay. So classic growth stage, you know, hey, let's grow this business, take it to the next level, let's scale. You obviously did a great job, you know, 5x revenue, you got to 100 million. What are you most proud of the journey? What would you say your biggest accomplishments were?
Well, so when I came into the company, you know, to give a little background, again, it was a good business, but there were several challenges, including really re-accelerating growth. But also, we had a really rough churn number. So like many SaaS companies, we struggled with churn. As I dug into that, it became pretty clear that going after these smaller clients was going to be very difficult. And we really had a product that was really suited for the enterprise, and we had a big opportunity there. So trying to do both well was going to be very hard. And it was already proving out. I mean, just as an example, our logo churn was very high, but if you really looked at it, it was really a small client.
So the dollar was less because the small leaving and you replace them with one large, those 5X or something like
that. Yeah, so we were thrashing about. In fact, you know, one of the metrics that'll kind of tell that story of the, you know, starting and ending. When I got there, we had about 1,400 clients.
Oh, wow.
And when I left, we had about 1,400 clients. So,
but 5X.
So that tells you the transformation that we had to go through to really get to that point. So those small logos were churning. In fact, when I got there, I think we had, you know, one out of every three clients was churning. I said, you know, the good news is I get to meet brand new clients every 3 years, which was not really good news.
Yeah, that's tough. In a SaaS business, churn will kill you for sure.
Yeah.
But in this case, like, how did you make the decision that like it was okay to churn the lower or SMB clients and move to enterprise? Because that's a classic move in that growth stage, going to 20 to 100. Yeah. But it's really scary when you've gotten to 20 with the first 1,400 clients. When did you when did you get conviction that was the right thing to do? And how did you impact that change or make that change within your organization?
Yeah. So it didn't take too long, but we had to dig in and really understand it. And it was certainly impactful. You sort of, you know, at the end of the day, you have to have the courage of your convictions. And so we dug in, looked at the data. You know, often what would happen, so if you have an enterprise SaaS solution that has, you know, some level of sophistication and complexity, you're almost always going to need some services to implement that product. And I think what was happening is, you know, I continue to see to this day, is companies love the idea of like, hey, it's a, you know, a PLG growth is great. We can just put it in there. The clients will use it. If the product is oriented for that, that's one thing. But if the product isn't designed for that, or it's really got such robust capabilities, you're really going to struggle with their small clients. And often what they would do is, you know, they'd want to buy the product without services. So one of the things we found out is if we didn't come in there and provide some services to help them to get off the ground, their success rate went down significantly. And so we looked at the data. It was becoming clearer and clearer that there was good opportunity up market, which is the other half of the equation, right? Yeah. You got to make sure that you really have something there. And we had enough good big clients, some really good brand, you know, big names, including, you know, Qualcomm and Disney and companies like that. So when you're selling to Disney and you're selling to, you know, a mom and pop or an SMB, you're really kind of in a tug of war. So,
and your large clients, they had the professional services. Is that one of the characteristics?
They knew that.
What were the metrics that were different? If you had those two cohorts and you're looking at the data, what jumps out that you're seeing? Is it the retention? Is it the expansion? Is it the
all of the above? I mean, that's the other thing. You bring up a great point about expansion. You know, so first of all, the average deal size was going to be much bigger. Our opportunity to expand the client was going to be much bigger. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we were going to have a better retention rate with those clients. So, it just started to become pretty clear that it's a hard sell, right? You've got to sell to these enterprises. But once you do, you have this bigger opportunity.
Yeah, and that does fly in the face a little bit about the product-led growth. And you're right, OpenView is a leader in that. You know, how would you have ranked the product when you got there in terms of its ability to be product-led and kind of self-service?
I frankly pretty low. I think we were at a point where we were hoping to create some kind of, you know, viral product, but it really was clear that, you know, and I've sold a lot of large enterprise software, you know, and back in the day where it was even, you know, more challenging where you're on premise. And if you don't work with the clients closely, they're gonna struggle mightily. So, you know, look, it would have been great if it was a product that could have done that, but it was really clear that it was built for something much bigger, and it proved to be the case over time.
So, okay, so you look at the data, you get conviction, you look and you realize you've got anchor clients, you've got better metrics there. How do you go about making that change in the organization? What were the challenges?
Yeah. So first thing was, like, you know, how do you stop selling to those small clients? Right. So you know, you sort of got to put a stake in the ground. And I think what a lot of folks do, cause you know, the companies I've been involved with recently as a board member and over the years, you know, they try to do it and say, well, companies of this size, they've got so many employees or whatever, and they kind of get themselves wrapped around the axle around that. What we did was we simply said, there's a dollar amount which you have to be willing to spend if you want to buy our product. Mm-hmm. And that's a qualifier very early in the process. And we just put a stake in the ground, said, you know, they're not willing to buy, you know, X amount of software.
What kind of ballpark figure was that?
Yeah, so the total would be $25,000 to $30,000 all in for ARR and services. It wasn't a huge number, but at the time,
but anything average, below that, you just had the data and the conviction.
If you couldn't, not worth it. Yeah, and it was a quick qualifier. So if the client choked on a $30,000, you know, quote, they were going to move on very quickly, and the reps were going to have to find better opportunities.
Did you put that into your sales process as a requirement?
And yes.
How was that received?
With some consternation, certainly. There's a lot of, I mean, the thing about those clients is we could sell them, you know, I always said they're easy to sell, they're hard to keep. So, you know, the sales team was like, well, I got three deals I can close. I'm like, yeah, but you know, how long is that going to last? We're going to say goodbye to one.
The ones below that threshold.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Prior. So, yeah. Ultimately, you know, they got on board. Some of them didn't like it. But we moved past that pretty quickly and were able, so it was a good way to, just qualify out.
Yeah.
And I didn't really care how big the company was, but if you couldn't afford that, that told me a lot. That you
and
just
did,
weren't
and so did you make your salespeople bring that up as part of a qualifying question early in the, you know, top of funnel process?
They certainly learned to, cause they knew that when push came to shove, they weren't going to get a deal. So
did you have to change the salespeople or the sales team based on, you know, aiming higher and sales motion, or was it?
There was a little bit of that. There wasn't like a wholesale change. We really just redeployed and really moved some of our more senior people up market and got targeted that. Because there's another thing we did almost at the same time, which was our land and expand approach. So that created sort of essentially two sales teams reporting up to our CRO, one for new business and one for expansion. Because as we said earlier, the opportunity of these big clients to expand was significant. And right. Once we set that in place, good things happened. And that was a big part of our growth over those years, is just being able to get into those big clients, get, you know, work the relationship, work through any issues they're currently having, to have the opportunity to expand into other areas of the company. And that worked
fantastic.
Well.
Fantastic. And you need to do that to get the value of moving up market, right? And grow with the company.
That's right.
It's different type of product led growth in that regard. You're being a little more hands on, but you're really trying to understand what your clients need. Did you bring someone in from the outside, or did you have someone internally to bring that lead that new group?
Well, there's over those years, I would say there's certainly a lot of changes in personnel. We brought in some new sales leadership, and then we ultimately, like I said, split it into new business and existing clients, and had folks come in. So I think it was a combination in those roles of promoting internally as well as bringing in people from the outside.
Cool. And then, so you cut off new business at that 25K mark or somewhere around there. You know, how did you handle letting go of the old clients that were below that, but they're still calling, still wanting service?
Well, I mean, we didn't like fire those clients. We, and okay. You know, if they stuck around, and by the way, there were some good clients in there. So Okay. Very capable, and they, but it was almost by chance, like, you know,
but you wouldn't spend money to get new ones.
Yeah, we weren't spending money to get
new ones. The ROI just wouldn't work.
And over time, they attrited out, you know, they really moved out over time. Some of them stayed who were doing well, but that helped us move our average client. So when I got there, I think our new client when we landed, it was around a $12,000 ARR, and the average client all in was like 15 or 16,000. So you could tell we hadn't expanded much, and we had a right. pretty low landing space. Yeah, I think a 12,000 ARR landing, unless you have a really quick expand, is a really tough level when you have an enterprise sales motion. So when I left,
really hard. You can't go from 20 to 100 with that either.
Yeah.
That just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You can go to 0 to 10 maybe.
Yeah. You'd be collapse of exhaustion on the side of the road doing that stuff. So, and that's kind of where we were because, you know, it was a leaky bucket problem with the churn too. Right. So,
right.
By the time I left though, we had an average ARR per client was over $65,000. And so we really moved that up and to the right. And it was a combination of moving away from those small clients and really expanding in our larger clients.
Okay, so that's an awesome story. And I think that's a really great one for listeners to understand. You know, you get to a different stage in the company, you have different goals, you're shooting for 100 million now. Economics have to add up to that. And this is part of that. Going enterprise is part of the playbook for that reason. And you talked about, you know, your sales motion, how you did that, but what was the strategy? Like, how do you grow from 20 to 100, and how do you go from 12 to 65 and find that expansion? How did you figure out, you know, what to focus on?
Yeah, that was the other aspect of what we did, and what, you know, as I walked in, I discovered while we had a good product and we're doing well in the market, it wasn't differentiated enough to really establish ourselves as somebody who is going to, you know, take a leadership position. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of people looked at it as a project management software. There are certainly other, you know, when I arrived at that time, there were certainly legacy players like CA and PlanView, some sort of big companies that were selling into the CIO and the project management office. That was a real, what I call a red ocean to fight out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's all these up and coming companies. Asana, which we probably many of us know today, was a brand new company,
sure.
and it was making moves. They were doing a PLG motion, Reich, Smartsheets, a bunch of companies that were coming along sort of from the bottom. And then we had these big, you know, legacy enterprise kind of heavyweight companies that were entrenched and had client relationships. So I knew it was going to be a tough to navigate if we didn't have some differentiation. So what we did was we dug in and we looked at where can we what is there a segment of the market that we can provide a unique value and really differentiate ourselves and establish a real strong position and frankly, a leadership position. And long story short, after that, we discovered that marketing teams across industries were a great place to focus because they did not have tools. And they were, you know, as we know, over the last 10 years, think about 2011, marketing is getting more and more dollars, right? You know, the Mark Benioff quote that the CMO is going to have a bigger budget than the CIO. So they're getting dollars, they've got a lot of demand for content, and they got a high velocity of activity going on, and they really didn't have tools to manage it. So we ended up partnering with a company that was and really just incrementally enhanced our product and went after those marketing teams. And we really started to structure around that and go after it. And that was a big aspect.
Was that more blue ocean?
It very much a blue ocean. Like you would walk into these marketing teams, and I'm talking big Fortune 500, you know, teams, you know, companies like Nordstrom, and they were really wrestling with this issue of how do I manage all of this demand that I'm getting? It's great, I have the budget, but it also comes with a lot of, you know, and it wasn't like IT that had really long multi-month or multi-year projects. It was really high velocity.
Those are great characteristics of a target market, and certainly the dollars were there, and I like the velocity.
Yep.
Did you force that? Did you kind of say, hey, we have to stop serving everybody, or was it more opportunistic? You had a couple clients that just were
no
just dream clients, and you looked at your product, yeah. your who are our best clients we want more of. How do you find marketing?
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of both. So a big part of our analysis was looking at some of our most successful clients and discovering that that was an area that we tend to have happy clients with good NPS scores and good renewals and so forth. So we certainly did that, but we didn't know for sure whether this was going to play out. So what we did was we incubated a small team to start to figure out if this is a space we could go after. It was, frankly, we just started with one of my senior leaders. I took him out of his day job and I said, you're going to, let's go figure this out. And slowly but surely, we expanded that team. And once we started to get traction with the prospects, it got very interesting. And we started to really click and people got very excited. So a couple of things we did was, one interesting story was, like, we started doing a demo and I looked at the demo. I said, I'm not sure, like, this is a little confusing still to me. Why don't we just put all the demo in a PowerPoint and annotate it and just walk them through a day in the life to show them and give them the vision of what we could do. And that worked. First of all, the team resisted it. Right off the bat, like, we can't do that. Well, sure enough, the first client we sold never even saw a live demo. They just saw the PowerPoint. Yeah. It was a real product behind the scenes, but it was just a much better way to communicate the story.
And was it a day in the life of a marketer?
Yes,
or a day in the life 100%. Of any business person doing anything?
No, 100%.
Like, could you even have done that had you not focused?
It would have been very difficult because you would have had to guess or try and figure out, like, what is your world like, if each prospect somewhat unique. But because we had done our homework on marketing, we knew what their world was like and we very much tailored it to them. And the response was almost like, oh my gosh, I had no idea there was a solution to my pain. And mm-hmm. It was like, hallelujah. So they got that.
Yeah.
So, it was very tailored to that market.
And you were speaking their language and you were speaking about the customer's problems, perhaps more than when you're demoing. I mean, there may be some really good demoers who work it in, but for the most part, you're showing baby pictures, right? You're showing, look at this feature, look at that feature, right?
Yeah.
Through your PowerPoint, you can say, let me talk about you, your challenges. And not surprisingly, customers tend to react better to that than your baby pictures, right?
Yes. So the benefit of doing that approach really had two benefits. One is to explain the story of the client much more succinctly. It also sort of handcuffed the demo person from going off into the weeds on a baby picture run, right? So it worked really well. Obviously, over time, we were doing live demos, but we were doing demos that were completely set up for their world. And as I said earlier, we integrated this third party product, which really enhanced it. And we showed that in the workflow. And it really worked out well. And that's when things really started to take off. So, between changing the focus to go up market across the board, regardless of who we were targeting, and getting out of that small business, and as well as going after these marketing teams, we really started to see the growth take off. And the beauty of this marketing thing was that we had such good success when we landed, it then gave us the right to expand into some of those other departments, which maybe we weren't as focused on, but we had, sure, we had the introductions that go across those companies. And again, these are large, typically Fortune 1000 companies, yeah, with a lot of opportunity.
So when you were focused, and you started the team, it started with one of your leaders, you partnered with a third party, you're seeing traction, so you kept doubling down, doing more and more. At the point at which you felt like you were really getting traction, you told me your growth accelerated. What was the before and after? Because I really want to, this is, I think, the lesson of this episode is, if you can focus and find a way to focus on your customers' problems because you're working on a specific niche that you really own, you called it Blue Ocean, I love that term. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Like, what are the KPIs or the metrics that are, hey, before it was like this, and now all of a sudden it's that. Like, if you were a forensic scientist and looked before and after, what are the before and after signals that you're going to see when you get that right?
Yeah. I'll give you a little philosophy before that. I think a lot of companies who are at this stage think that they have an operational execution problem when actually they have somewhat of a strategy problem as well. We always have to grind away on our metrics, but if you have a strategy problem, you're gonna just have to work harder, right? And you're grinding it out. You don't really have that differentiation, that you'd love to think you do, but oftentimes it's hard to really express to the prospect. So
And what you're describing is a change in go-to-market strategy.
Correct. Yes. And so, you know, again, some of the metrics we already talked about, our landing numbers were bigger in terms of ARR. We didn't have to worry about that 25K issue or any of that. So we were landing at a bigger level. That metric was better. Our retention numbers were better. Our client satisfaction number, I mean, really across the board. And then if you look at net, you know, gross retention, which is a key metric for a SaaS company, and net retention, both of those numbers moved up. You know, frankly, our gross retention when I got there was a bit embarrassing. But by the time I left, it was in the 90s, and the net retention was in the 110% plus range. So those were really key elements of, you know, what we looked at in addition to the top line was going up.
How about your sales cycle? Like did you get efficiency in the sales cycle? Yes. And did that translate to happier salespeople with more earning more money?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. We had our top sales person, you know, was breaking new records every year in that group. And it really became a lot more fun for the sales team. You know,
for everybody.
First of all, the industry references itself. So the leads are more warm as they come in. Second of all, the sales cycle is shorter because they know, you know, you're very focused on it. And they're frankly, the competition couldn't do a good job of it. So you sort of checkmated the competition, even though over time they started to try and imitate it. But we really had a huge head start. And then the win rate was just way better. I mean, our win rate improved significantly. So we had 100 deals. We were going to win, you know, a lot more of those than we were previously. And that's an efficiency. It leads to LTV to CAC benefits and a whole bunch of other things.
So how long did it take? I mean, that's an incredible turnaround. It's music to the ears of a go-to-market leader, but I'm sure it wasn't that easy.
Yeah, it wasn't overnight.
How long did it take to get to, you know, starting to see those trends?
I would say that once we started incubating the concept, we were probably a year in when we really knew we had something going. Like the numbers weren't huge yet, but we were showing that we had something, and we started to build out the team. And by the way, one of the things we did on the team is we didn't just put people on it or people that were sort of being moved through the organization, which is often what companies will do. They're sort of say, well, we're reorging. This guy's good, but we don't have a spot. Let's put him in here. We took our very best people. Mm-hmm. Like literally our top people in each functional area as we built that core Tiger team. And I think that made a huge difference in terms of how we went forward.
No, that's awesome. And I bet it also probably took the commitment and leadership from the very top, from you, right? Because organizations don't just naturally change. They kind of stay in motion.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, that's a great point. So I sort of had to shelter that team and sort of put some, barriers around them because the antibodies often kick in for the company.
Yeah. Right.
They either want to sort of, you know, oh, come on over and join us. And then it gets sort of lost in the sauce or they just think it's a crazy idea and you're, you know, and why are you guys even doing this? So, it was a good, you know, I don't want to say the team was good across the company, but we really had to make sure these guys had the freedom to do what they needed to do and not get caught up. So that took a lot of involvement on my part and pushing back against some resistance at times. But then once they started seeing the success, it was sort of like, oh, okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's one of the things from a leadership perspective that, you know, a lot of times, you know, one of the things that a quote I remember hearing many, many years ago from a senior leader was do more and go faster. And it just said in a vacuum, like, well, you know, it just is, it applies at all times.
A little chaos producing its potential, right?
Yes. But, you know, I can't think of times where I moved too fast and I didn't do enough. It was always, you know, why did I wait? You know, so, that was really absolutely, part of it. But ultimately, it became a key driver of our growth. And ultimately, the company was sold to Adobe over time. And it was because of what we did in marketing that Adobe was interested in the company.
That's awesome. What a great story. Thank you, Eric. That's awesome. If you go back and tell yourself in 2011 there, you know, one thing, what would you tell your younger self?
I think probably it's a, you know, it's a lesson you kind of learn repeatedly over your career, but it has to do with really people and making sure you got the right people on in the right seats and making those hard decisions quickly. It's back to, you know, move fast and do more. Mm-hmm. So often you try to make it work and you kind of in the gut know it's going to be a challenge and you ultimately end up in the same place after all. And a lot of times it's not because the people are bad. They just may be miscast or, you know, we're making changes that, you know, I always believe in the right person at the right time. And when you're growing fast, that time may be shortened. So there may be a 2 or 3 year run that this person is the right person, but, you know, over time you may need to bring somebody else in. So the lesson learned would be just have the courage of your convictions and move fast on making the organizational changes that you need to make to achieve the vision you're looking to achieve.
Especially once you've got your strategy dialed in, then you know it might require
different players. That's critical. That's a very good point. Yep.
Fantastic. What are you doing these days?
Oh, well, these days I'm dabbling with a variety of fun SaaS companies. I'm on the board of several earlier stage SaaS companies, which has been a great experience for me because these are a bit earlier stage than I'm used to. The companies I had run were more like Workfront. But yeah, just helping out, you know, founders, entrepreneurs and their teams to build out, you know, great companies and what's a tricky environment right now for a lot of them, both from a market perspective as well as from a funding perspective. But they're all doing well in their own way. I've been through enough of these ups and downs over the years, you know, to kind of help them weather those storms.
That's awesome. Where can people find you?
Find me at LinkedIn would probably be the best place. I'm out there I'm trying not to work too hard, but keeping pretty busy.
All right. Well, I'll send people your way. Okay. I think you got a lot to be able to help people with, and I'm grateful you shared these lessons with our listeners this morning. Thanks, Eric.
Great. Good talking to you, Julian. Thanks.
All right. Talk.
Thank you for listening to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you please follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast player? And we'd be grateful if you recommend it to a friend. If you'd like more resources on how to become a better leader in business, we invite you to visit us at growthelevated.com. We'll be back next week with more insight from another great tech leader. Thank you.